Good evening, my dearly loved brethren and sisters and young people. Josiah is one of those characters in the scripture that everyone is drawn to at some stage or another. And I'm going to give you five reasons tonight, young people, five reasons as to why we need to sit up and take notice of this man. The first reason is that we've got some details about his youth. Now, you know, that's actually fairly rare in the scriptures for the divine record to record details about someone when they were really young. But we have details about this man's life. I might add, there's not a lot of detail about when he was young, because almost everything we know in the two chapters in Chronicles and the two chapters in Kings happened in 1 year of his life. I don't know whether you've ever noticed that. We'll come to that later. But the first thing, the first reason why we need to sit up and take notice is that he was young when he began to serve God. Okay, the second reason is that he lived at the end of an age when society around him, both outside and in the ecclesia, was falling apart. The society that he grew up in, young people and brethren and sisters, was morally bankrupt. It was socially incapable of supporting the nation of Israel anymore. And there were tremendous pressures on everyone, on families, on young people, and there were allurements, distractions abounded around Josiah. It was a very, very dangerous time to be growing up in a person's teens, because there was just so much to take them away from what God really wanted them to serve. Young people, we all know that we're living in the last days. You know what the Apostle Paul said about the last days? He said, perilous days they would be. That word perilous means very difficult to handle. And Josiah understood what it meant to live in days that were very, very difficult to handle. But you know why we need to sit up and listen to him and have a look at his life and come to see what he did? Because he handled them. He handled them better than most of us could ever expect to handle the difficult times that are around us. He can therefore be our mentor. The third reason why we need to stop and look at this man's life is that despite the environment that he grew up in, despite all the debauchery around him and immorality that was seducing all of the nation as a result of the legacy of Manasseh, his grandfather, despite that, we read these words in 2 Kings chapter 22 and verse 2. And I'd like you to turn there. And this is a summary statement of his life that we read right at the beginning of the king's record here. Verse 2 of 2 Kings 22. And he did that which was right in the sight of Yahweh, and walked in all the way of David his father, and turned not aside to the right hand or to the left. You know, we can sometimes very glibly read straight across the scriptures, can't we? You just stop and think about what that's saying about this man. He did that which was right in the sight of Yahweh. You know, young people, it doesn't matter what anyone else thinks of our life except Yahweh. And this young man did that which was right in God's eyes. And God penned it through his prophets. Here it is for us to read. This is the divine seal of approval on this man's life. This wasn't just a goody-goody that just happened to do a few things right. As far as God was concerned, he did that which was right in Yahweh's sight. And do you know there's not a single negative thing recorded in the whole record of Josiah's life? There isn't David's. There isn't many other faithful men, but not in Josiah's. Doesn't mean to say he was perfect, but he's an incredible example. And we need to sit up and take notice of him. But you know, if we just leave that verse there, we're missing something very important. Because it tells us that he also walked in the way of his father David, and he turned not aside to the right hand or to the left. He never ever deviated to the left or the right. And he had every single opportunity you could possibly name. Young people, you know what it's like growing up in a world like this. And there's all kinds of distractions that will pull us one way or another if we only open our eyes and let that happen. It's so easy to happen. And Josiah was living in exactly the same sort of times. And he never ever deviated to the left or the right all his life. Now, it's worth coming to grips with the power that drove that man. You know, those words are never, ever said of anyone else in the whole of Scripture. So there's reason number three for us to stop and think. But here's reason number four. He was an absolutely unique individual. Turn the page. 2 Kings chapter 23 and at verse 25. And like unto him, the record says, was there no king before him that turned to Yahweh with all his heart and with all his soul and with all his might, according to all the law of Moses? Neither after him arose there any like him. There wasn't one before, there wasn't one after him. There wasn't a king before or after him that was like this man in this respect. He was marked out by his response to the word of God. There was no one that turned unto Yahweh with all his heart and all his soul and all his might according to the law of God, or the law of Moses, as it says here. Really, that's one of the reasons for our major theme for this week, trembling at his word. And we're going to come back to that a little later on in a later study. So he's marked out as a unique individual, and twice is there divine approval on this man's life because of his characteristics. But you know, reason number five is this, young people, that he had a profound effect on other people. Some people, that effect was life-changing. He permanently changed the lives of many people in the nation of Judah and Israel. And some people, he only changed temporarily. But you know, young people and brothers and sisters, this man changed people. There was gross idolatry and immorality in the nation. And this man came in and people were drawn to him. They would have wanted to keep on going in their old ways. But the king said, no, this is what we're going to do. And he called them and read the law to them. And they saw this man, in all his sincerity and humility, make a covenant with his God there that day, and the people made a covenant too. Now, some of those people, it was the last thing in the world they ever wanted to do was make a covenant to serve Yahweh, but they found themselves drawn to this man. You know, when he died, brothers and sisters, the whole nation turned out to mourn for him. You would have thought that they would have rejoiced, because the next week, they're all back in their idolatry under their new king. They didn't rejoice. There was something about this man that drew men to him and began to change them. And it wasn't just all temporary. It was for some people, but for others it was life-changing, the contact that they had with this young king. He's an amazing individual by any standard we like to name, whether it's divine or human, and we need to come to know him. Whether we're young or old, brethren and sisters and young people, we need to find the key to this man's life. You know, the common view of Josiah's life is that he was a young, energetic, enthusiastic, godly young boy that grew up very faithful, and he began to try and change the nation around from idolatry, and alas, he failed because his work was doomed. And well, it was very sad to really see that he struggled all that time, and then he just died with an Egyptian arrow that out of the stray hit him on the plains of Megiddo. And well, that's Josiah's life. If we think that's what Josiah's life's about, brothers and sisters, we have vastly misread the divine record. You know, from God's viewpoint, he was anything but a failure, absolutely anything but a failure. He was a positive success. And before the probation, the time of probation, which typically in Scripture is 40 years, he didn't even live 40 years. Before his time of probation was up, God said, "That's enough, Josiah. You've done everything I wanted you to do." And he took him out of the way. And his life had been an incredible success as far as God was concerned. We're going to revisit that in our last study. But he lived in very, very challenging times that only those who have ever lived in last day periods could really appreciate. He was flanked by on both sides by the worst kings of Judah. There's seven kings on that chart there, and Josiah is one of them, and he's there in the center, and there are six other kings who collectively made up the six worst kings of Judah. And there we find Josiah's life embedded right in the middle. He followed two of the worst, and then three of his own sons and one of his grandsons followed him, and they all followed the previous kings and not Josiah. Well, it's a very big conundrum as to how all that happened. But he was the only shining jewel in the midst of this period of gross darkness in the nation of Israel, a nation of Judah. You know, brothers and sisters and young people, that should make us stop and ask a question. What is he doing there in the middle of this blackest part of Judah's history? How come we've got such an incredibly enthusiastic, godly, faithful man that's raised up in the midst of that generation of total darkness? The light comes on for a short time, goes out again, and the nation goes into captivity. You know, when we finally find the answer to that question, we're not going to answer it tonight. When we find the answer to that question, it's really going to put Josiah's life in its true perspective. You know, this whole period here of 100 years and going into the period of captivity just after, because they went off into Babylon, is a period of history over about, I suppose, 200 years from the reign of Manasseh. Or in fact, if we take from the reign of Josiah for about another 100 years from his reign onwards, is a very interesting period of history and a very important period of history from the divine viewpoint. Did you know that in that period, there are more than 10 books of the Old Testament written and recorded? And that period produces some of the greatest men of all time. I'm talking about people like Jeremiah, Daniel, Ezekiel. Those three major prophets all came into this period of history and struggled with the difficulties that Josiah also was struggling with. But there's a tremendous number of conundrums and paradoxes that arise out of this whole period. For example, how come after two generations, in fact it was a very long generation in the case of Manasseh, and then Ammon only reigned for a couple of years, how come Josiah turned out like he did with a father and a grandfather like that? And how come he had three sons that were absolutely apostate, and then a grandson that was really no different as well? It's really a very great difficulty to work that out, isn't it, as to how that would actually have happened? Well, the background to Josiah's life really goes back into the period of Manasseh, and that's where we've got to start tonight, and that's why we've read 2 Kings chapter 21. Manasseh was Josiah's grandfather, and what an utter disaster his reign was. He was the longest reigning king of Judah, and he was the worst of all the kings, and interestingly enough, he had the best father to boot in Hezekiah. So we've got some really difficult things to sort out here, haven't we? Hezekiah, a very great king, has a son like Manasseh who reigns for 55 years and absolutely decimates the people. So much so that God says in his reign, the nation's going to go into captivity. There's nothing can save it from this point onwards. We'll have a look at 2 Kings chapter 21 and verse 2. Let's start there. This is what we're told about Manasseh. And he did that which was evil in the sight of Yahweh after the abominations of the heathen whom Yahweh cast out before the children of Israel. Oh, look, we have to stop. Do you know, when kings are introduced into the record, we know that very often, particularly if they're a king of Judah, they're usually compared with David. Look at this one, Manasseh. Did you notice? He did that which was evil in the sight of Yahweh, not following David's way. It says, after the abominations of the heathen whom Yahweh cast out before the children of Israel. Amazing. Absolutely amazing. Look at verse 9. But they hearkened not, and Manasseh seduced them, that's the people, to do more evil than the nations whom Yahweh had destroyed before the children of Israel. It's repeated again and again. Verse 11. Because Manasseh, king of Judah, had done these abominations and hath done wickedly above all that the Amorites did, which were before him, and had made Judah to also sin with his idols. This man wasn't just compared to the nations around. He was worse, absolutely worse. And these nations, we're told in the record here twice, God picked them up and threw them out of the land. You know, it was very clear, both to Abraham and later on, Moses revealed it in Deuteronomy chapter 9. And you can look this up later if you like. That God said to the people of Israel, I didn't bring you into this land because you were more righteous than everyone else. In fact, that's not the case. He said, I brought you into this land because the iniquity of the people who were in there was so bad that I was going to inject them out and I used you to kick them out. Well, what was he going to say now? When one of Judah's kings is on the throne for 55 years and all the divine record can say is that he was worse than the Amorites. You know, when the iniquity of the northern kingdom reached that of the Amorites and the Canaanites, God ejected them. Down came Assyria, and out they went. And now we've got a king of Judah who's exceeded them all. Not only apostate himself, but he seduces the whole nation. And that's been repeated. We notice that in verse 9, verse 11, verse 16 as well. Three times it's repeated. As if the divine penman here can't believe that he just has to keep writing it down to come to grips with this. See verse 16, moreover, Manasseh shed innocent blood very much till he had filled Jerusalem from one end to the other, besides this sin wherewith he made Judah to sin in doing that which was evil in the sight of Yahweh. You know, the list and the litany of sins that we read, that was read for us here by Michael tonight, say starting from verse 3, is written in such a way through to about verse 8 or 9 that there's a sort of sense of incredulity of the divine historian here, as though he can't even believe that anyone could be doing what this man was doing. For example, verse 3, for he built up again the high places which Hezekiah, his father, had destroyed. How could you do that? How could you have a father like Hezekiah who went and cleaned out the land and you come into power and immediately put it all back again? And he reared up the altars of Baal and made a grove, as did Ahab, king of Israel. There's his mentor, Ahab, of all people. And he worshipped the host of heaven and served them. And he built altars in the house of Yahweh. Not even Ahab did that. Not even Jeroboam did that. This man's gone over the top. And to make it even sink in deeper, look what the divine penman says. Verse 4, of which Yahweh said, in Jerusalem will I put my name. Oh, this man has gone right over the top. He's not only taken Phoenician customs, he's taken Canaanite customs, Moabite customs, Ammonite customs. He mixed in a bit of Assyrian stuff because he took the hosts of heaven, and Babylonian entered in as well. And he took a bit from Egypt and then he set up altars for the host of heaven, verse 5, in the two courts right inside the temple. Can you believe this? And he made his own son to pass through the fire and used enchantment. He got involved in the occult. Oh, that's an interesting addition to the concoction which he was producing.
and he did wickedness. And he set a graven image of the grove that he had made in the house which Yahweh said to David and to Solomon, in this house and in Jerusalem which I've chosen out of all the tribes of Israel will I put my name. That's how much spiritual sensitivity Manasseh had. He produced and introduced in the midst of the nation there a mixture of gods and their practices that not even the pagans outside had become involved in. And he blended that all into the worship of Yahweh, and people didn't really know what they knew they were going up to the temple, and they knew Yahweh could be worshipped there. But inside the temple was a disgusting image that he'd set up. And in the courts, you could worship the hosts of heaven. And outside, you could do other things. And all of this was in the house of Yahweh, and all the people knew it was the house of Yahweh. And he mixed it all up, desecrated the house of God, where God had decided to put his name. And as we read in verse 16 a moment ago, not only that, he added to all this that he shed innocent blood very much. That is, anyone that dared to oppose his new reforms and his tolerance of other people's idolatry would lose their life. As the prophet Isaiah said, and Isaiah is actually, according to tradition, one of those who lost his life at the hands of this brutal beast. And Isaiah said that truth is nowhere to be found, and he that departeth from evil makes himself a prey. And if you departed from evil and you stood up for Yahweh alone, and you decided that you wanted to worship the one true God and didn't want anything to do with his other concoction, and you did it in Manasseh's reign, you would have lost your head. Josephus says the streets flowed with blood every day. Now we know Josephus is given to a little exaggeration, but it's telling us that this was a time of utter terror for those who were righteous and wanted to stand up for what those things that were right. And it was because of this man that Judah was going to go into captivity. Turn over the page, chapter 24 of 2 Kings, verse 3. Surely, at the commandment of Yahweh came this upon Judah, to remove them out of his sight, for the sins of Manasseh according to all that he did, and also for the innocent blood that he shed, for he filled Jerusalem with innocent blood, which Yahweh would not pardon. Yahweh would not pardon. And Jeremiah confirms this, that it was at this point in time, when Manasseh was on the throne, that Yahweh determined that Judah would go into captivity. So deeply grained was this apostasy, young people and brethren and sisters, that not even all the initiatives of Josiah for 31 years, and he tried to reform the nation, he instituted the worship of Yahweh again, he got the priests working, he had tithes brought in, he held the feasts. He did everything to try and revert that nation back to the worship of Yahweh, and not even that could remove the blot. Turn back a page, 2 Kings 23, verse 26. This is at the end of Josiah's life. It says this, after Josiah's tried all of these things through his reign, it says, notwithstanding, Yahweh turned not from the fierceness of his great wrath wherewith his anger was kindled against Judah because of all the provocations that Manasseh had provoked him withal. And Yahweh said, I will remove Judah out of my sight as I removed Israel, and I will cast them out of this city which I have chosen, and the house of which I said, my name shall be there, because they didn't deserve to be there. What a situation for young Josiah, coming on the throne as he did at the age of 8, to inherit. It seemed that his efforts were doomed from the day he became king. In fact, before he even started. And yet Josiah came to the throne and in his early life tried to turn that nation around, right? Tried to reverse the situation and turn them back to Yahweh. Let's just take a different stance for a moment. Let's just look at the wider political situation of the time. There we have a map of the Middle East area, and in particular, it shows Assyria at the height of its power, which was in fact just before BC 640. The Assyrian superpower had dominated the Middle East for many years, and of course, as you know, there were really two big players up until that time. There was Egypt in the south and Assyria to the northeast, and those two players pushed at each other over many years. But Assyria had gained the dominance, and you can see that the territory that Assyria was ruling over went right down into Egypt, and that was at the height of its empire. But when they came down to take Israel captive, under God's direction and by his providence, they transgressed and went too far, and God, through the prophet, said that they were doomed and the nation of Assyria would decline, and that it did exactly from that time. And so we come to the time of Manasseh's reign, which was really the king that was reigning on the throne of Judah after the northern kingdom had gone into captivity, because you'll remember that the northern kingdom went into captivity when Hezekiah, who was Manasseh's father, was on the throne. So during Manasseh's reign, there was a concerted attempt, a collusion really, between Egypt and Judah, Manasseh being on the throne there, and Syria to the north of Israel, to break away from the tyranny and from paying the huge taxation that was due to them every year to Assyria. And as a result of that, Ashurbanipal, who was one of the really great Assyrian monarchs, in fact, he was the last of the really great Assyrian monarchs, moved to squash that rebellion. And everything appeared normal, that is, that he was just moving to try and crush the rebellion that had started there and put them all back in subjection so they'd keep on paying their tribute to him. But God tells us that he was behind all of that. Come to 2 Chronicles. We'll turn to the Chronicles record now. 2 Chronicles chapter 33. Because here we're told that God was at work. 2 Chronicles 39. And at verse 9. So Manasseh made Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem to err and to do worse than the heathen whom Yahweh had destroyed before the children of Israel. And Yahweh spake to Manasseh and to his people, but they would not hearken. Therefore Yahweh brought upon them the captains of the host of the king of Assyria, which took Manasseh among thorns and bound him with fetters and carried him to Babylon. It doesn't say anything in this record that Manasseh was trying to get out from under the tribute along with Egypt and Syria, but that's in fact from the political situation what was happening. But God was at work. And God, because Manasseh wouldn't hearken and because the people wouldn't respond, God brought upon them the captains of the host of the king of Assyria. Now that's very interesting. It shows the accuracy of the Bible, you know, because it was Ashurbanipal, who was the ruling monarch at the time, but it was his policy to only go into battle when he really had to, and he preferred to use his generals. And that's exactly what this says. He brought upon them the captains of the host of the king of Assyria, who at this time was Ashurbanipal. Well, and they took Manasseh among the thorns. Well, that should better be rendered with hooks, meaning hooks in the nose. And if you've ever seen any of the relief drawings on the walls of the photographs of them from Assyrian palaces and so on, you'll see that that's exactly what they did with their captives. They put rings through their noses with chains and dragged them off. And that was the fate that happened to Manasseh here because he'd rebelled, bound him with fetters and carried him to Babylon. But the most amazing thing is in verse 12. And when he was in affliction, he besought Yahweh his God. Yahweh wasn't his God. He besought Yahweh his God and humbled himself greatly before the God of his fathers and prayed unto him. And he was entreated of him, and he heard his supplication and brought him again to Jerusalem into his kingdom. And then Manasseh knew that Yahweh, He was God. Do you know that story is almost unheard of in Assyrian annals? For a king to be taken captive, hooks in their nose, dragged off, humiliated, to appear before the king in Assyria, to be released and allowed to go back to their own country and take up rulership again. Absolutely unheard of. But the reason it happened is that God was at work here. And that this man had actually genuinely repented of what he had done. He humbled himself greatly before the God of his fathers and prayed unto him. And how long that took, we don't know. And he was entreated by God, and God allowed, in fact, God influenced the great Assyrian monarch, Ashurbanipal, to let one of his captive kings to go back to their nation again and take up residency as king, and as long as they continue to pay tribute. What an amazing thing that is. But it's even more amazing, isn't it, that God forgave this man, because this is the man of whom he said, I will not pardon. I will not turn around from all that Manasseh has done, and this nation is going to go in captivity. How could God now turn around and forgive a man like this when he'd killed the prophets, he'd banished the priests, he'd perverted the hearts of the people for 50 years and seduced them to sin, so that every generation from then on until they went into captivity went down the same track of perverted immorality? He slaughtered the innocent in their thousands. He oppressed the poor, the widows and the fatherless. He destroyed the nation's soul, brothers and sisters, and God forgave him because he repented. And he came back to Jerusalem. That would have to be the greatest example in the Bible that I know of the forgiveness of God. Because a man turned, after all that he'd done, he turned and God responded. And then when Manasseh got back into his own kingdom, then the record says in verse 13, he knew that Yahweh was God. Because he must have known what Exodus 34 said. And as he thought about all the characteristics of God that are listed, of Yahweh that are listed, merciful, gracious, long-suffering, but won't clear the guilty. He now has experienced the character of God in his own life. He's turned around and God's actually moved and shown compassion, whereas he would have not cleared him in the past. Well, he comes back and he tries to reverse the whole, tries to undo everything he'd actually done before. He tried to rebuild Jerusalem. He cast out the idols. He removed the strange god out of the temple, and he reinstituted the worship of Yahweh. He repaired the altar and he made sacrifices himself there. And he commanded all Judah to come in and make sacrifices and to serve Yahweh only, because now he knew he was the only true God. He should have known that when he came to the throne at the age of 12 with a father like Hezekiah. But he destroyed the nation, and now finally he realizes that Yahweh is really the true God. What an amazing transformation. But you know, brothers and sisters, it was largely ineffective, because you can't undo 50 years of apostasy in 5 minutes. He'd killed nearly every faithful man in the land he could find. If anyone stood up for right, they were a target, and he took their head. And now there's hardly anyone left alive who can help him rebuild the nation, can help him direct the people back to Yahweh anymore. And the people all were very skeptical. This man had taught them how to worship every god under the sun. And now he's saying, no, cast that all out and you only worship Yahweh. They looked at him sideways and thought, oh, we don't trust this man. We know what he's like. And so his own work was basically fruitless. You know, even his own son, and Ammon at that stage was a teenager, resisted the changes. Chapter 33 of 2 Chronicles, we've got it open there. Look at verse 22. And he did that which was evil in the sight of Yahweh, as did Manasseh his father. That is, before he repented. For Ammon sacrificed unto all the carved images which Manasseh his father had made and served them. It shows us the importance of early youth, doesn't it? Of childhood, because he reverted to that. He didn't listen in his teens because he'd been perverted when he was a child. That's a lesson for parents. And he humbled not himself before Yahweh as Manasseh his father had humbled himself, but Ammon trespassed more and more. Now the king's record says he forsook Yahweh and walked not in his ways. That seems to indicate that for a time Manasseh may have tried to force him. Said, this is what we're going to do, son. But he forsook Yahweh. He made a conscious decision, I don't want anything to do with just this single monotheistic religion. It's boring, there's no fun and excitement in it, and I don't want it. And he forsook it. And he trespassed more and more in the sight of God, as verse 23 there tells us. You know, he had a total disrespect for elders and his parents. Now, it's a spirit, young people, brethren and sisters, that's a spirit that's seen every single time a society begins to break down. In any age when societies have begun to crumble, there's one sure signal that it's happening, and it's the rebellion of teenage youth. You know, that's what the 2 Timothy chapter 3 says. Paul says in 2 Timothy chapter 3 of what would happen in the last days. It's what Paul said in Romans 1, talking about the end of the era that was going to end in AD 70. A reprobate world will always have rebellious teenagers. And today, young people, you know what it's like growing up in a world like today. Youth culture, especially in the Western countries, have tried to break parent-teenage bonds. They're trying to make you think that it's normal to have a rift with your parents. You know, young people, it's actually not. And scripturally, God never ever wants any rifts in families. He wants absolute harmony all the time, and it can be achieved. But it can only be achieved on his principles. Whatever you do, young people, don't follow the trend of a world that's corrupting and about to pass away. Because through all manner of means, whether it's through music or dress or language, the youth culture of today tries to separate teens into a culture of their own that's different from all other adults, different from every other part of society. Don't be an Ammon, because that's what he did. He trespassed more and more, and he went right against the wisdom of his father who'd learnt from experience. Young people, value your parents. I don't know whether there's any parents in this hall that are perfect. And there's no kids that are perfect either. But we ought to value our parents and those who provide for us a godly environment. But you know, Manasseh looked and looked, and eventually he found a small but faithful godly remnant. It was only a few. Some of these must have been in hiding for many years, hiding from his sword. People like Hilkiah, Meshullam, Huldah, Shaphan. And he began to draw them into the palace. You know, it would have taken great courage on the part of some of those people to actually come anywhere near this man. Given his history over 50 years, he could have done anything. It could have been just a ploy to catch them. But they realized that God really was at work here. And they came back in because they saw a genuineness in Manasseh's repentance. Well, he brought into the center of just a few godly people around him to build a little microclimate in the area of the palace where young Josiah would grow up. That is utterly amazing to see that God is moving the superpowers of the nations to effect his purpose, so that at just the right time,
is going to be someone in Jerusalem who can protect a godly environment into which this young boy is going to be born and then take the throne at the age of 8. You know, Manasseh was unable to undo all the damage that he'd done, but he was used by God mightily for a great work, because what his work was to protect that environment in the palace. And you can imagine what he would have tried to do to that young boy. You know, he could see that his own teenage son, Ammon, was going astray. It was going worse and worse and worse, and he was now in his late teens, and he wouldn't hearken and wouldn't listen. He's out in the valleys and on every high hill and on every green tree with all the idolatry that was around, having fun and enjoying himself to the full. And his life came to an end at 24. But there was a little boy, the age of 3 and 4, growing up in the palace. See, the lives of Manasseh, Ammon, and Josiah overlap by about 6 years, if you put the chronology together, which means that Josiah was alive in the last 6 years of Manasseh's reign, in the time, I believe, in which he'd converted, repented, and was back in Jerusalem, because he had time to build up Jerusalem, he had time to take out the idols, had time to do lots of things, and that would have taken, was a work of some time. And so there's this very interesting little period when there is an establishment for 6 years of, in a very early life of Josiah, of an environment that was godly. And it's interesting to just imagine what Manasseh might have done. We don't know. We don't know what sort of man he was. But he must have impressed upon this little young boy and upon those who were around him and others impressing it as well, that there is, Josiah, only one God, only one, and it's Yahweh. And he might have walked him around the walls of Jerusalem, looked over down into the valleys. Josiah, do you know your great-grandfather was down, lived in this city, and all around these walls, the Assyrians came in. There were thousands and thousands of them. As far as you could see, there were Assyrians out there. And one night, the angel of Yahweh slew all of them. Can you imagine a 5-year-old boy soaking up a story like that? And you know, Josiah, it was because your great-grandfather Hezekiah trusted in Yahweh alone. You see all those idols around? They're nothing. If you push them over, they break. They can't do anything. Josiah, there's only one God. And a 5-year-old can learn that. And I believe Manasseh did whatever he could, with others helping, to impress upon this young boy at a very early age. You know, God was also working in the whole area, the whole world politics still. Because the Assyrian Empire became very troubled from this time onwards. There was over here in the east Elam that tried to attack the Assyrians, and then the Medes had a go, and the Scythians poured in like a swarm of wasps down across the land and just devastated things. And then Egypt rebelled. And then some other area, the Babylonians, began to exert their might. And Assyria was pulled in all kinds of different directions, and they had to base back in the centre of their empire and count their losses, and they started to lose territories on the outside. You know what? God confused all of those circumstances so that over here in Assyria, There was so much turmoil that Assyria was no longer interested in Judah. And down in Egypt, there was all this infighting down in Egypt. They were trying to sort out who was the boss down there. And they didn't bother anyone up there. And for 30 years that happened on the international scene. And then God just suddenly withdrew. And it all came together. And Josiah lost his life in a battle between Egypt and Syria. But for that 30 years, the nation was at rest. Because into dry ground was going to be born a little shoot that needed to be nurtured. And he had a work to do. And it needed peace. And that's what God provided. Well, it's an amazing story, isn't it, really? This protected environment that Josiah grew up in involved many more than Manasseh. Manasseh's role initially was just to protect those people so that they could have some influence in at least the palace area. And finally, we find that Ammon was quickly taken out of the way. He was an ungodly man that was only interested in himself. He was vain. He was not concerned about his young son Josiah, it appears, and that was a good thing from the divine viewpoint. And he was quickly slain by his own servants. And at the age of 8, Josiah came under the throne. And there were a number of very influential people. We're not going to look at any of these in detail. But his mother, whose name means beloved, it's from the same root word as Jedidah, Solomon's name, means beloved. And she was the daughter of Adaiah, that means Yahweh hath adorned. A beautiful two names. And it possibly tells us something about this young woman who had within her grasp a precious little boy. And just as Amram and Jochebed had the opportunity initially of influencing the very, very early days of Moses' life, so did Jedidah here. Now, we can never, ever underestimate the importance of a mother's role in the very, very early years of the life of a child. You know, young people, that's a lesson for you to take on board. Because most of the parents that are here tonight have children that are well and truly past that age. Well and truly past the cradle stage. But what you've got to understand is that if Christ returns and you're given the privilege to marry and have children, that it's those very early years that are so terribly important and precious. Because if God was going to do any work in this nation, he had to raise up a young boy that was only a few years old, and he had to be in a godly environment. You know, a long-term study that was recently published, or a few years ago was published, was done in New Zealand over about 25 years. And it tracked the influences on children from birth right through to their 20s. And you know what they found? They found that the most important years of a person's life in determining the direction that they were going to go was the years 0 to 2. Not only that, it has been estimated that 50% of pre-teenage learning occurs in the years 0 to 4. Those years are critically important in developing godly attitudes and preparing someone like Josiah for the work that he had to do. So his mother was obviously playing a very important role, though we have to read between the lines and we're not really told the full details. But there are a few other interesting players, like Hilkiah, the high priest, who was probably the father of Jeremiah, and Jeremiah was almost certainly about the same age as Josiah. And it was the custom in Israel that if a king was too young to reign, then the high priest took over and held the reign of the kingship and made the decisions until the child was old enough, which in this case was until the child was 16. And he became a real father figure in the nation, and one that Josiah in his later years trusted very greatly and put a lot of responsibility on. So his impact must have been quite considerable, and especially if Josiah and Jeremiah are about the same age, they must have had a lot to do with each other and their households. But there were two other people that are named there, Meshullam and Huldah, who were married.
One was a Levite, the keeper of the wardrobe, and Huldah was a prophetess and lived in the vicinity of Jerusalem. And those two are very, very interesting characters. And we haven't got time to look at them in detail, but if you track through the historical records and through Jeremiah, you find this remarkable family link-up. That's the family of Meshullam and Huldah. And there are four sons named, and then their sons and sons after that. And the ones that are shaded in blue are those that were immediately active in Josiah's reign that we know of, that are actually listed and named in the story of Josiah. And the others in green are very faithful companions of Jeremiah in his difficulties. And many of the others were as well. But those particularly, the sons of Shaphan, were particularly mentioned in Jeremiah as being quite significant. If you'd like a copy of that, it's on the second Bible marking sheet. There's going to be Bible marking sheets available on some of the evenings, and it won't be the one available tonight. It'll be the next one that will have that with more detail, I might add, on it. But it's some of these people who, in their latter years, had a very profound stabilising effect on the environment and gave godly instruction and wisdom to those around who were supporting the development of young Josiah. And I think Josiah had a very, very strong connection to Huldah because, you know, when eventually he heard the book of the law, his immediate reaction is he had to get Yahweh's opinion about this, and he sent to Huldah. Now, there were several other prophets in Judah at that time, and some of them very close friends of his. And you would have thought that he would have gone to one of those, but no, it was to Huldah that he sent. He wanted to know what Huldah thought, because she had, I believe, very evidently had a significant impact upon his early developing life. And it must have been a very difficult task for them and Shaphan and some of the other contemporaries like Zephaniah, who was his cousin, the prophet, and Masaiah, the governor of the city later on, to have held at bay the influences of evil that were sort of overrunning the country at the time. But these people that are named there, and others, and there are others in the record that are named, both in the period of Jeremiah as well as in the historical record of Chronicles and Kings, formed the core of strength of the nation. They didn't transform anything. All they could do was hold on to the worship of Yahweh in their tight little circle. And it was that faithful group of elders who were experienced and had wisdom, and the young friends that Josiah was growing up with, good friends, the vital ingredients in his development in godliness in an evil age. And it's absolutely no different today. Because, you know, outside the palace of Josiah, the apostate worship went on apace. It was an awful picture, because what Ammon and Manasseh had instituted originally was just rampant from one end of the land to the other. And no one was able to stop that. Even though Manasseh made this vain attempt to try and turn some of that back, he never ever was successful. And Ammon came in and changed it all anyway within 5 minutes. And the picture that the prophets paint is a really terribly depressing picture. It was one of oppression and violence and deceit from the highest to the lowest forms of society. Everyone, the priests, the prophets, everyone was given to deceit and violence, and no one was honest. And there was mixed idolatry, which was sensual and had immoral practices. The people were covetous, Jeremiah tells us. They were self-centered. They were pleasure-seeking all the time. All they wanted to do was rebel against anything that God said. They lived double lives or triple lives all the time. And Jeremiah cried out one day, and he said, Yahweh said to him, run through the streets and see if you can find just one man that works righteousness, and I'll save this city. Just find me one. That's what the nation was like. It was like that outside the palace. Evil was made to appear good. And good, what was right, was seen as evil. Young people, that's our world. What Josiah had to contend with is exactly
what we're contending with. And subtly, values, standards, fashions, ideals have slowly deteriorated all around us as we've watched. It's happened during my lifetime. And those who've lived much longer than me are horrified at the dramatic nature of the change that's happened in our society all around us here. And tolerance in Josiah's day was branded as a virtue as long as it was tolerating evil. You couldn't tolerate good, but you had to be tolerant of everything. Does that strike a bell? Strike a chord today? Tolerance is this catch cry of our modern world. You're not really educated and up with it unless you can be tolerant. Tolerant of any perversity, any evil. But you can't stand up and say, this is right. This is the only right way. No tolerance then. So Josiah understands what we're going through too. And there was acceptance in Josiah's day of all manner of practices and lifestyles and beliefs. You know, I believe, brothers and sisters and young people, one of the most dangerous things about Josiah's society that was introduced by the previous kings that came before him was this multiple mixed slurry of idolatry. Now, you might say, oh, well, we don't have idolatry, or I contend that we struggle with idolatry and our issues are just the same as they were in those days. But it's this mixed idolatry in Josiah's day that was the real problem. You see, what people could do if there was lots of different things, that you could become involved in the occult, or you could worship the stars, or you could get involved in Baal's worship, you could be involved in religious prostitution over in that direction, you could go and have all these other practices over here if you went to that. You could basically decide for yourself. It was a mix and match. And if you didn't particularly like child sacrifice, well, you didn't have to do that. You could do something else. And you could also have the worship of Yahweh if you wanted to, because the temple of Yahweh was there as well. And in Josiah's day, that's exactly what the people were faced with. They were faced with this mixture, and everyone could choose whatever they wanted. And the truth was just one of those many mixtures, you know, brothers and sisters and young people. That's exactly what the situation is today. We are living in a world where you can have anything you want. Most of us have within our means the ability to just about follow almost any lifestyle that we would really want to do. We could do almost anything we want, most of us. We can have whatever we want. And we can have the truth. And there's all these mixed things all around. And we can just pick and choose. But was God happy with that? God said to them when they came to the land of Canaan, get rid of the lot. Don't leave any standing. None. Serve Yahweh with all your heart and all your soul. And all your might. Don't pick and choose. There was the danger. You come to Jeremiah chapter 7. This is what Josiah's contemporaries found. And this is a very, very powerful warning for today. A very big challenge. Jeremiah 7 and verse 8. He said to them, behold, you trust in lying words that cannot profit. Will you steal and murder and commit adultery and swear falsely and burn incense under Baal and walk after other gods whom you know not, and come and stand before me in this house, which is called by my name, and say, we are delivered? The RSV says, only to go on doing all these abominations again? You see, that's what this mixed bag of idolatry produced. It really deceived the people of Judah into thinking that they Well, they could still do what they wanted to do if they weren't in the temple. But when they came to the temple, well, they would come to the temple and they would worship Yahweh, and then they'd go away and they'd be involved in all kinds of other things. Their whole lifestyle was mixed up with all these other idols around them. And Jeremiah says, are you going to live a life like that and come into my temple here? It's called by my name, and say, oh, that's very fine for this week. All your sins forgiven. That's great. Let's off we go again and start all over again. Don't think, said God, you're going to desecrate my temple. With a deceived heart, they were taken away. And Josiah could have grown up in that environment. Mixed multi-gods and picked anything he wanted. He could, as king, have had absolutely anything he wanted. And you know what? The only thing that is recorded in the first 12 years of his reign is one sentence in 2 Chronicles 34 and verse 3. I'd like you to come there. 2 Chronicles 34 and verse 3. There's only one thing we know about this first 12 years. Verse 3. For in the eighth year of his reign, that's when he was 16, while he was yet young, he began to seek after the God of David his father. He began to seek. That tells us, young people, that he had a conviction and a sense of purpose. You don't go seeking things that you don't know anything about. But the most amazing thing of all is that he actually sought Yahweh at all, given the environment that he was growing up in. And add to that, young people, he had no Bible. Because that wasn't found until the 18th year of his reign. Now this is the 8th year. It was 10 years later that he had a Bible in his hand. And by this stage, by the time he is 16, he's beginning to seek the God of David his father. And fortunately, for all that time under the providential hand of God through the work of Manasseh and the nations holding off and so on, all of that providential work was coming to fruition. Because now he'd been allowed to grow up in a godly environment that had been protected from the evils out there. Parents, never, ever, ever think that we shouldn't protect our children, particularly when they're young. We're foolish if we think that we want them to go and learn the ways of the Canaanites around us. It's going to be absolute sacrifice of our children. And Manasseh and those who were looking after Josiah knew that. He'd been in this protected environment that had allowed him to learn what was right and what was wrong. He learnt in a very young age what was absolute values, right and wrong. There was absolutely nothing inevitable about the course that Josiah took. He had to choose which influences to follow and which he was going to reject. He had to choose what counsel he was going to listen to and what he was going to ignore. But you know what he worked out, young people? By the time he was 16... he'd worked out that most of his peers were absolutely deceived. And he gave his ear to the elders and to the experienced around him. And he did that before he was 16. So at the time he got to the control of the throne, he came onto the throne at the age of 16 to take the nation itself and to reign in his own right, still with guidance, no doubt, but to take the decisions of the kingdom seriously, he had begun to seek the God of David, his father. You know, young people, there's some profound lessons we've got to take away from this man's life, and we're going to come to some of these again in tomorrow night's study. But we've got to take heed to the attitude of this young man. If you're growing up in a godly home where the Bible is open, where it's read and loved, be eternally thankful for that.
and look honestly at the decisions of life, at the issues of life, and make decisions early in life. Don't just wander aimlessly through life, all through your teens and into your 20s, and still not know where you're going. This man had worked out by the time he was 16 where his life was going. He just didn't decide at 16, I'll have a look at the Bible, see what it says. Well, he didn't have one to look at for a start. He'd given his mind and his attention earnestly since a little child. And what he'd done is this, young people. He'd looked at his father, Ammon. He'd looked at his other contemporaries around, and he'd thought about them. All of those people thought they were free. They thought they could do whatever they liked. Had thrown off the shackles. They could go where they liked, when they liked. They could do what they liked, and no one would stop them. And Josiah must have looked at that and thought, that's slavery. Absolute slavery to self. Why would anyone want to be like that? All clones. All doing exactly the same thing. There was nothing noble. There was nothing honourable, there was nothing inspiring, there was nothing worthwhile. Where did it all end? His own father had been killed by his own servants in his own house at the age of 24. What did it achieve? It was deceptive. It was empty. And then he looked at his great-grandfather. And his own grandfather after he'd changed. And David back before, and Jehoshaphat, and so on. And they were men of character, they were men of purpose. They were free to follow what was right, and they forged their own path. They weren't clones. They listened to God because they knew it was best for them. And actually, in the long term, it turned out to be best for them. And the end was contentment and satisfaction and pleasures and peace, and oppression was not even part of their life. He saw around him all these people given to the filth and immorality of youth and the pleasures that were there to be had. And he refused it. He set his heart to seek God because he followed his mind, not his eyes. Young people, if you learn nothing else in your youth, in a godless world, learn to follow your mind and not your eyes. You know, Josiah had a son who refused to follow his mind. He was told over and over again, Zedekiah I'm talking about, told over and over again by Jeremiah what he should do now. And he was always indecisive, and he felt the pull of what he should do because he knew that this is what he should be doing. But he would never find the courage to do it. And in the end, he followed his eyes, and the Babylonians got hold of him and poked him out. Josiah learnt before he was 16 to think about the issues of life and to weigh them all up. You know what Paul said to Timothy? Listen to these words. You've heard them many times, but listen to them in this context. He said in 2 Timothy 3, evil men shall wax worse and worse. What does that make you think of? Deceiving and being deceived. But, Timothy, you're living in a world at the end of an age when people are getting worse and worse, and they're deceiving themselves, and they're being deceived, and they're deceiving others. But continue thou in the things which thou hast learned and hast been assured of, knowing of whom thou hast learned them, and that from a child you've known the Holy Scriptures, that are able to make you wise unto salvation through faith. It's not a matter of what you're seeing and thinking, oh yeah, that would be good, I'd love to do that. Oh yes, look at this over here, let's go out here tonight, let's do this. Life can be a ball, young people, if we live like that for a very short time. But Josiah saw the issues. He didn't seek out Canaanite haunts. He didn't want to go out to the green hills, every green tree, the high hills. He didn't want it.
He knew that if he let himself go out and have a look and play around, he would have liked it. But he never ever moved out of that godly environment. And he sought wholesome friends that wouldn't deceive him, but that would encourage. You know, parents, there's great encouragement from the story of a Josiah. Because what it's saying is that it is possible to raise up godly children in the midst of an evil age that's debauched and ready for judgment. It is possible to do it because Josiah proves that it's possible. But the key is to provide a microclimate in our homes and in our ecclesias. Our homes have got to be havens where the truth is loved and lived. And there's got to be a strong foundation for children and teens in an age that's fast moving. Young people, it's no good just going hither and thither all over the place, roaring around like the whirlwind this world is in. We'll only end up like Ammon. Josiah began to seek the God of David, his father. You know what that word seek means? It's a very interesting word. Make a note of it if you haven't got something in your margin. It means to beat a path and hence follow by searching. To beat a path. Do you know what that means? It means this. That Josiah began to form habits in godly thinking. He began to practice godliness. And his real interest was in divine things. It wasn't in all the peripheries of life. And there might have been many things around him that were harmless in their own rights. And we might be able to list a whole range of things in our lives that we think are not in themselves evil, but could well become distractions, like sports and all kinds of other pleasures. Beating a path and seeking Yahweh, brethren, sisters and young people, it's not just turning up to an occasional young people's class. It's about a disciplined, regular contact with divine things. What are we doing with our time? There's a Bible marking sheet available tonight. See if you can have it done before the next study. Get some friends together and do it. Because that's the spirit of this man, Josiah. He set his mind determinedly to seek the God of his father early in his life. It wasn't imposed on him. It wasn't a decision that someone else told him he had to do. It was his own decision, brethren and sisters, and it lasted all his life. And with great fervor and energy, he never let up. He never turned to the left or the right all his days, because in his youth, he'd remembered his Creator. He'd taken heed to his elders. And he'd begun to beat a path in his life. Before other paths could form in his mind and in his life, before other habits could start to take over and become too attractive and too hard to break and change. Youth is the best time, young people, to serve God. The best time to seek the God of David, our Father. Well, what have we seen? Importance of seeking good friends in the truth. Good friends. Friends that don't deceive us, but friends that help us. Be thankful if you're growing up in a godly environment. Treasure it. Both at home, in your ecclesia, in your young people's circle, and do everything you can to maintain it. Respect and obey parents and elders. Goes without saying, doesn't it? But it's a sign of chaos and breakdown. Know what's right and know what's wrong. You know, we've got to, increasingly in the world we're living in, those two things are blurred, even reversed. But we've got to be clear about what right and wrong is, and be prepared to stand up for what's right. And to shun evil and all the world's allurements, and make decisions of the mind and not of the eyes. And generate in ourselves and within each other, and to help others to generate a desire to know the God of David, as Josiah did. Because youth, young people, is the very, very best time to serve God.